This is Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero in for Rose Aguilar. She's coming back on Tuesday, the 11th. This past Tuesday, Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Department of Health and Human Services cleared the first hurdle on his path to confirmation. After Senate hearing, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination was narrowly advanced by the Senate Finance Committee in a 14-13 vote along party lines. Now it heads to the Senate floor for a confirmation vote. That's expected this week. The nomination is grossly problematic, to put it mildly. RFK Jr. promulgates discredited and retracted studies to claim that vaccines are unsafe, Wi-Fi causes cancer, and AIDS in Africa is a whole different illness than AIDS in the West. Nothing on his resume qualifies him to head an agency the size or importance of the HHS. And when he was first nominated, Time.com spoke to Lawrence Gostin, director of Georgetown University's O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. He said, "I can't think of a darker day for public health and science itself than the election of Donald Trump and the nomination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health. To say RFK Jr. is unqualified is a considerable understatement. The minimum qualification is fidelity to science and scientific evidence. He spent his entire career fomenting distrust in public health and undermining science every step of the way," end quote. If he's confirmed, Kennedy could radically reshape this country's approach to public health. He'll oversee programs including Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Health Care Act. He'll lead epidemic responses and the approval of drugs, vaccines, and other medical technologies for public use. Along with nominating Kennedy, Trump has taken other steps that may jeopardize public health. He oversaw the purging of data from federal health agency websites. Most scientific communication from federal health agencies is now blocked from public release. In January, Trump ordered the U.S. out of the World Health Organization. All this as bird flu is rapidly spreading among livestock and other mammals in the U.S. Now, bird flu isn't new, but this past year's explosion of H5N1 cases in poultry farms, including infections in dairy cows and sporadic human cases, has experts concerned. Millions of birds are being culled to contain the spread. New outbreaks are emerging worldwide, confirming that it's widespread among migratory bird populations. Alarms sounded when scientists at the World Health Organization for Animal Health reported the first case of a rare strain, H5N9, on a duck farm in California. That is commonly not found in birds, but it was detected alongside the more common H5N1 strain. With so much at risk, good information is critical. So we're so pleased to have for you today two of the leading experts in epidemiology and public health. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is a professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University School of Public Health. Her work focuses on global health security, public health preparedness and response, and health systems resilience. She co-leads the development of the first ever Global Health Security Index. That's a crucial tool of analysis of global health and healthcare capacities. She's the founder of the Outbreak Observatory, which conducts operational research to improve outbreak preparedness and response. Dr. Paul Offit is with us too. He's a pediatrician specializing in infectious diseases. He's an expert on vaccines, immunology, and virology. He's a professor of vaccinology and pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He received numerous awards, and he's the co-inventor of a rotavirus vaccine, which was recommended for universal use in infants by the CDC in 2006 and the WHO in 2013. Both our guests regularly advise government health agencies and other organizations on public health matters. Paul and Jennifer, welcome to Your Call. I can't tell you how much we're pleased to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul, I can't help but pick up where I just left off, looking at your credentials. Your vaccine got the nod from the CDC and the WHO. Over 1,000 pages have been purged from the CDC website, and that's just a portion of those that reappeared, as reported by healthjournalism.org, showed up in varying degrees of their former completeness. A note went up on the site. It says the CDC's website is being modified to comply with President Trump's executive orders. Are you open to sharing what's going through your mind as these hits just keep coming?
Sure. I think it's a dark time. The CDC is the principal epidemiological organization in this country. We need to know what's going on. Bird flu is a perfect example. What we need to know, if that virus ever mutates to the point that it can reproduce itself in the upper respiratory tract of humans. Now, it hasn't done that yet, but it certainly could do that. And if it does do that, then we have pretty much a blank slate in this country and this world where that virus could spread. We look to the CDC for providing that kind of information. And if immunization rates continue to erode as they have been over the last few years, I think you're going to start to see more measles outbreaks. We need to know where they are, how many they are, how to contain them. And I feel like we've lost this important tool.
Jennifer, I have to say that when I was researching this hour, you'd almost call it intuitively. I went to the CDC for information, and then it occurred to me I may not be looking at what's complete or accurate. Now, obviously, you've spent your time with government agencies. I'm curious if you're hearing anything from inside, if you still have contacts with people who are working with the CDC or with the HHS. What's the morale like, and what are you hearing?
Well, I mean, I think it's widespread, deep concern about these developments. I mean, what we're really seeing is an unprecedented attack on not just our health agencies, but just federal scientists in general. And, you know, these are people who have, devoted their lives in the service of our nation, many times foregoing higher paying jobs, in part because they believe in the mission of keeping America safe and secure. And so, you know, that is deeply concerning. But the effects are larger than just the federal workforce. I mean, if you talk to anyone working in public health or in medicine, particularly people who are working in our communities, our state and local health practitioners, they've never seen anything like this in their career. They're deeply concerned that not only are data sets being taken down from federal health agencies, there's indication that they're going to be tampered with by political forces, not scientific factors. They're also unable to have the regular kinds of conversations that they depend on in order to know what is going on in the world and the United States that may affect the health of our communities. And not being able to have those conversations, that really puts us on very vulnerable ground. So people are worried for lots of different reasons.
I may be taking you out of your field of expertise, and if I am, let me know. But have we learned anything about any sort of precedent in the past about how this might be legally challenged, how to get that whole information back up where it belongs?
So I don't know about legal challenges. I'm not an attorney. However, mm-hmm. I will say in terms of precedents, I mean, I'll just give you one very concrete example. There is a report that the CDC puts out weekly called the MMWR, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. This was something that was actually founded by my late mentor in 1960.
Oh.
And every single week since 1960, that report has been put out. It is a scientific report that contains data and an analysis of the data. It is the primary way that the CDC can communicate back and forth with state and local health officials and with clinicians and the American public, sharing crucial evidence, sharing an analysis. It's not the same as what's on its website. It is a scientific paper that individual authors sign their name to and sort of stake their own personal and professional reputations on. And it has been a critical tool in alerting us to crucial evidence about emerging health crises, like the first few cases of disease that were ultimately determined to be caused by HIV infection when we first discovered it. The discovery of the 2009 H1N1 pandemic influenza strain. That report has been critical and has been published without interruption through multiple periods of American political history. And yet, with this most recent presidential transition, has been taken offline and hasn't been published for the last couple of weeks.
Paul, what can this mean in terms of access to research and research money? I know that there's so much in research that's dependent on grants. Has that been touched yet?
Yeah, well, there was a freeze, certainly, for a while. I mean, my division, the Division of Infectious Disease, depends on grants. We have a lot of basic science researchers that do basic science research that is funded by the National Institutes of Health. And there's a fear that, you know, that there's going to be major cutbacks. I mean, what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said, remember when he was running for president, he said, you know, quote, I think we need to give infectious diseases a break for 8 years. And relieve the people who are currently at NIH of their duties and replace them with people who are only going to focus on chronic diseases and not infectious diseases. So although he may think we're going to be able to, he wants to give infectious diseases a break for a while, infectious diseases aren't going to be giving us a break. We've had three coronavirus pandemics in the last 20 years. This isn't going to be the end of it. And it's just hard to watch someone like him ascend to the highest reaches of public health, knowing that he holds these odd thoughts. I mean, think when you said that he thought that HIV is different than Africa than the rest of the world. Read his book, The Real Anthony Fauci. He doesn't think HIV is the cause of AIDS. It's that bad. He doesn't believe in the germ theory. Read pages 288 to 291. He does not believe in the germ theory of infectious diseases, meaning that specific germs like viruses or bacteria cause specific diseases and that the treatment or prevention of those viruses or bacteria can be life-saving. He doesn't believe in that.
I can't help but think, Paul, I'm going to stay with you for a moment. I can't help but think that the coverage of his hearing in front of the Senate was not as full as it could have been. There were some very dramatic moments going on there. When he was challenged on his science record, he was challenged about his involvement of deaths in Samoa because of being an anti-vaxxer. And I just feel like it fell on deaf ears, not only within the Senate, where everything went along party lines, but I didn't hear it really escape that much into the larger public. Do you have any impressions of that?
No, I agree. I mean, he was challenged with statements that he'd made or things that he'd written. And his response was to say, well, no, I never said that. Or I never wrote that, when that they clearly was a record of that. The thing that upset me the most, actually, in that hearing was when he would consistently talk about chronic diseases. We have more chronic disease than ever before, especially in children, where the incidence of chronic disease is 1 in 36. That's what he said. Well, that's the incidence of autism spectrum disorder. So that's what he's talking about. And what does he think causes autism spectrum disorder? Vaccines. He was asked that question over and over again, including by Senator Cassidy, in addition to Senator Sanders and others. And he would never admit that the science is overwhelmingly in support of the fact that vaccines don't cause autism, which tells you everything you need to know. If you have someone who's about to be the head of HHS who believes that vaccines cause autism, why do we not think that he's going to do everything he can to make vaccines less affordable and less available? I think we are in for one rough road.
Dr. Paul Ovitt is professor of vaccinology and pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, talking to Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University School of Public Health. Jennifer, this would be funny if it weren't tragic. During the hearings, RFK said, "I am pro-safety. I worked for years to raise awareness about the mercury and toxic chemicals in fish. Nobody called me anti-fish. I believe that vaccines play a critical role in healthcare. All my kids are vaccinated. I've written many books on vaccinations. My first book in 2014, the first line of it is, I am not anti-vaccine. The last line is, I am not anti-vaccine." I am taking a wild guess, Jennifer, that doesn't reassure you at all.
No, it doesn't. And I really have to give credit to Paul, because he wrote a really brilliant opinion piece in the New York Times about don't call Robert F. Kennedy Jr. a vaccine skeptic. Skepticism is what scientists are. Scientists are trained to, you know, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. We need to interrogate the evidence and make sure that we kind of run our hypotheses down to the ground before we accept evidence. And Paul, in his leadership as a vaccine developer and as a scientist who's worked on vaccines and also on advising the FDA, has served in that role of being skeptical about vaccines until the evidence convinces him otherwise. What Robert F. Kennedy as Paul rightly says, is a cynic, meaning that he has already determined the conclusion. And he has held on to that conclusion despite mountains of evidence. He doesn't want to see that evidence. He chooses not to see that evidence. I argue that it's not done out of beliefs. It's actually done out of profit motives. I mean, his organization has been incredibly profitable. They have really taken advantage of the fact that when you say outrageous things on social media, you get a lot of clicks and likes give you a lot of money. And so the profit incentives from that, as well as the profit incentives of filing frivolous lawsuits against vaccines, really align to put you in a situation where he just, you know, won't accept any evidence that counters the views that he has espoused for a very, very long time.
I'm interested in hearing what you think about that, Paul. And let me take some figures directly out of the news to what Jennifer was mentioning. In the Merck litigation, he has an actual financial state. Now, what he is a referral expert within the lawyer group that is suing Merck over the Gardasil vaccinations. And Merck has stood by its science and stood by its testing and said there is no danger here. Now, his financial stake, Kennedy's financial stake in the Merck litigation, says he's entitled to 10% of the fees awarded from that lawsuit. If they win, that is not inconsiderable. Senator Warren said at the hearings, you've taken in $2.5 million from his referral business. I want to know if you'll commit right now that not only will you go to work for drug companies, will you not go to work for drug companies, you won't go to work suing the drug companies and taking your rake out of that while you're secretary and for 4 years after. And Kennedy said, I will commit to not taking any fees from drugs companies while I am secretary. You're asking me not to sue drug companies. I'm not going to agree to that. Paul, your thoughts on that?
Well, think about it. For the next day, he sort of modified it to say that he wouldn't keep the money personally, but would give it to his son, which is not particularly reassuring.
Yes.
Also, look at the position he's in. I mean, if he's the head of HHS, he can manipulate the vaccine injury compensation program. He could say, I want to expand the list of compensable injuries for Gardasil or other vaccines. He could pull vaccines out of that program and just let them suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous civil litigation. But the Gardasil lawsuits are interesting because the way it works is that in the mid-1980s, there was put in place the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which contains the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. So you really can't directly sue pharmaceutical companies initially. You have to go through this program. So he and his personal injury lawyer friends are of the belief that the Gardasil or HPV human papillomavirus vaccine causes autoimmune diseases or causes neurodevelopmental diseases. So they submitted that to the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, where it was rejected. It was rejected because dozens of studies have shown that's not true. So he figures, all right, I'm just going to go to a civil court where I'll have to just convince juries as compared to, you know, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And so he doesn't take no for an answer. When he says all I want is high quality science, when he gets high quality science, he ignores it because it doesn't fit his fixed, immutable, science-resistant hypothesis. And this isn't going to end. I mean, if he's head of HHS, he can manipulate that system to make himself, or at least his family, as well as his personal injury lawyer friends, even richer.
I want to go back to his money because we haven't touched the surface of what he's making off of all this. He founded and until a few months ago ran the Children's Health Defense. It's a nonprofit, but it richly profited him. According to NPR, he made $326,000 over 3 years running it. You figure in 2022, and it's up to $2.1 million that he raked in. While it sued the U.S. repeatedly over vaccines, including COVID shots for children. Now, he says he stood down from the organization now, but we add in his referral work, as mentioned, from Wisdom Baum, $856,000 in referral fee for just 1 year of work. As you said, Jennifer, this is coming as much from money as it is from any belief system. To complicate that, he is talking to his fans who did show up at the hearing and called out, "We love you." And he's talking to people who do have genuine beliefs about this. What do we do in conveying to people what the genuine risks are from someone who's in it for the money?
Yeah, well, it's one of the biggest challenges. And, you know, it is a very difficult prospect because if you think about what do medical and public health professionals have to do regarding vaccines. They not only have to communicate highly technical information about both the safety and the effectiveness of vaccines, they have to do that in an information environment that's completely saturated by lies, for which the more outrageous things are far more buzzy and far more easy to see just because of the algorithms that propel them forward. They also have to communicate in a way that not only are competing for your eyeballs in that information environment, but communicate in a way that makes you do something, you know, make an appointment with a healthcare provider, not always easy to do, not always convenient to do, get in the car or take transit to go to a place. And then at the end, you know, of when you get there, possibly get an injection, which we know a lot of people fear. So it is a really, you know, it's a very difficult battle for medical and public health. And the people like RFK Jr. and the other sort of, you know, anti-vax profiteers, all they have to do is just raise questions and raise enough questions to either make you yield to the fears that you may have in your heart, or raise enough questions to make you deprioritize the effort that it would take to go out and get a vaccine. So really, really difficult. Now, if you add that whole giant challenge to the fact that we are now dealing with a policy environment where health agencies are not only not able to communicate, but they have been, you know, instructed to pull back on really pertinent health information and modify that scientifically grounded health information to align with political ideals. I mean, this is just really, you know, in many ways a public health cataclysmic event that is going to make it very, very difficult for us to have healthy communities.
We're going to go to a break here, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation about bird flu and RFK Jr. with his potential and, in fact, expected confirmation as the head of the HHS. Dr. Nuzzo is professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University School of Public Health. She co-leads the development of the first ever Global Health Security Index. Dr. Paul Offit is the recipient of numerous awards, the co-inventor of a rotavirus vaccine. He's professor of vaccinology and pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Vaccine Education Center, more vital than ever before, at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Just in from the news agencies, we're going to quote the Washington Post here. Elon Musk's Doge team is feeding sensitive federal data into AI via Microsoft's cloud to target spending cuts. We'll look into whether that level of getting into personal information and using it for federal data cutting might have some effect within the health sector as well. That's coming up after the break. Also after the break, we'll be taking your comments and questions on this essential topic. We'd like your contribution via our phone lines or email. The phone lines are open now at 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255 if you prefer it that way. And if you prefer email, we're watching the inbox. Write us at yourcall@kalw.org. That's on the phone, 866-798-8255 or email yourcall@kalw.org. I'm Angie Coiro. This is Your Call. We'll be right back. And we're back on Your Call. Rose Aguilar comes back on Tuesday the 11th next week. We're so pleased to see her coming back. In the meantime, we'll continue our conversation about RFK Jr. and bird flu. To bird flu in just a moment, but this did just come over the wires, the old style way to say it. Elon Musk's Doge team is feeding sensitive federal data into AI via Microsoft's cloud to target spending cuts. His representatives from the Department of Government Efficiency have fed data from across the Education Department, including personally identifiable information for people who manage grants and sensitive internal financial data, into artificial intelligence software to probe the agency's programs and spending, according to two people with knowledge of the actions. This shows how Musk's group, which includes former employees from his tech empire, is tapping the favorite tool of Silicon Valley as part of its mission to drastically slash the size and functions of the federal government. Paul, obviously this is going to raise concerns in the health sector as well.
Right. It's a big black box. It's unclear what's going to happen. I mean, Elon Musk was not elected. He wasn't appointed to any committee, I mean, or any department. Department of Government of Government Efficiency is kind of a made-up department. And it's he's just been sort of given the keys to the kingdom and just asked to go wild. I have no idea how this is going to play out. I mean, I have friends at the CDC who have emailed me in the last couple of days saying all their meetings have been canceled. A lot of them are looking to get out because they feel that their mission is been upended. And that's been the goal. I think the goal of the Trump administration is to basically attack institutions and turn them upside down. And the people who are heading those institutions, like Robert Robert F. Kennedy Jr., have disdain for those institutions. And that's what we want. That is apparently what we voted for. And that's what we're getting. Look at Project 2025 regarding the CDC or the FDA or the NIH. You're getting what was all outlined in that particular document.
Let's go to the World Health Organization news. Right after he was inaugurated, Trump pulled the U.S. out of WHO. And of course, he did that before. And then President Biden put us back in, and now he's back out again. So on the side of the organization itself, that can be a fiscal disaster. The U.S. is funding up to the tune of about 14% of WHO's budget. Trump dismisses that. It's consistent with his rejecting concerns about any damage to most countries outside the U.S. On the U.S. side, does this make it actually harder for us to fight epidemics and pandemics? Jennifer, what does it mean when funding comes out of an outside organization? What happens to us inside the U.S. as far as fighting epidemics?
So it absolutely makes it harder to fight epidemics, and it absolutely makes it harder to protect the health of our communities. And let me give you a really specific example. So we have a lot of events, infectious disease emergencies happening, not just in the United States, but in other parts of the world. And we know that infectious diseases do not stay put. They do not take breaks. One of the most important interventions we have in the fight against these infectious diseases is communication. So when there is a suspected Ebola outbreak happening in another part of the world, at the same time that there are security concerns and an ongoing effort to return to the United States Americans who had been in that area, to have our health agencies like the CDC not able to call the WHO and find out what's going on compromises their abilities to perform their statutory responsibility to protect America's health. They need that information not only to know how we can extract Americans from that situation safely, but also to share that information with communities who may ultimately be the places where these diseases turn up. So, you know, there's a lot of attention on what the U.S. withdrawal means for the operations of WHO. And I don't want to downplay that because we are, I think, an important leader in that organization, and not just from our financial contributions. I think we can help set the direction of their work and influence the direction of their work. But I think there's been a lot less attention on what we as a country lose and how this is very much not aligned with our national interests. Not only does it make it harder for us to know what's going on and to have that information and to use that information to more effectively protect Americans, but it also potentially sends a signal to the rest of the world that this kind of international compact of ours, this agreement that we are going to, when we have events happening within our borders that have the potential to spread across our borders, that we see it is in our collective best interest to share that information readily so that we can protect ourselves. And so I also worry about America's departure, and will that mean that other countries are going to decide, you know what, detecting and reporting outbreaks is no longer worth it to me. Mm. And that is going to harm all of us.
Wow. To the phone lines, as promised, let's talk to Christina in Oakland. Christina, welcome to your call. Hi, Christina, you're on the air.
That has the potential to spread across our borders.
Christina, I'm going to put you on hold for just a minute. We're going to have you turn your phone down, and I'll bring you back in just a second. We want to be able to put you on the air. In the meantime, we're going to talk about the rise of bird flu, and then we'll come back to HHS involvement in fighting bird flu. And the latest comes out of Nevada, where a variant that has circulated, a variant of H5N1, the common bird flu, has turned up in dairy cattle for the first time. And those findings were relayed in a short update from another U.S. department, the Department of Agriculture. It traced the new variant back to dairy herds in Nevada. It's known as the D1.1 genotype, belongs to a different genetic lineage than what's fueled the infections in dairy cattle over the past year. Paul, we heard earlier about H5N9 showing up in California. Is D1.1 different from H5N1, or are we looking at two different variants?
No, it's a variant within H5 viruses. So to put it broadly in perspective, the influenza viruses are bird viruses, and they generally bird viruses. They've spilled over into people, and they're characterized by this protein on the surface of the virus, the hemagglutinin or H protein. So there's 16 different H proteins, H1 to H16. There's only three of those viruses have ever become human pandemics, H1, H2, H3. H5 has never become a human pandemic, but it's been around for, you know, for at least 20 years. It's in dozens of countries. It's caused more than 1,000 cases over the past 20 years or so, but still that virus has never learned to spread from one person to the next. What you need to worry about is whenever you see one person spreading the virus to the next and the next, that's when you worry. And this is where the CDC and academic immunologists and virologists come in. You need to see when that virus mutates to the point that it can bind to the upper respiratory tract. That hasn't happened yet. And so we'll see. As a general rule, the virus can kill birds because it can reproduce itself in the upper and lower respiratory tract. It generally doesn't kill cows because it doesn't cause respiratory disease in cows, but it can replicate in the cow's udder. That's why you can see it in milk and in people who work in dairy farms. So I think we'll see how this plays out. But to date, H5 viruses have never been a human pandemic. And someone who was a mentor for me, a man named Maurice Hilleman, who was in many ways the father of modern vaccines, he really either did the primary research or development on 9 of the 14 vaccines that we give to young children. I interviewed him in sort of the last 6 months of his life for a book that I was writing. And he was a flu expert, and he said he thought H5 viruses would never be a human pandemic, and he was dying. He said to me, and I'll be looking down or up to see whether I was right, which was classic, Dr. Hilleman.
As promised, we're going to go back to the phones. The number, if you'd like to participate, is 866-798-8255. You can also email us yourcall@kalw.org. When we put you on the air, please remember to turn your radio down because you are on a delay. Going back to Christina in Oakland. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Yes. So what I wanted to say is I'm a lifelong Democrat who totally supports RFK for dealing with the chronic ill health of Americans. We don't have to be, you know, brilliant to see that many, many people are obese and many people have diabetes. And the food on the shelves in the supermarket is mostly not really food. So I think it's really exciting that we have the opportunity to have someone who is absolutely committed to addressing that. And I'm disappointed that you guys are repeating the trope that he's anti-vax. He said over and over and over again that he is not anti-vax. He's vaccinated. His children are vaccinated. He's just really concerned about honest representation of the science. And I feel like you're whipping up fear that's not legitimate because I listened to the hearings. He absolutely reassured all the senators that he was just going to follow the science. And anyway...
Well, hang on, Christina, because I want to get responses for you. I mean, this is a very important phone call, and I appreciate it. Let me start this off with Jennifer Nuzzo. Part of what we're hearing is a disconnect. Part of what's concerning people is a disconnect with what has happened with RFK Jr. making money off the vaccine lawsuits and saying he's not anti-vaccine, what he's saying versus what he's doing. But I do want to be fair for him, and I'm glad Christina calls in. What is your response to her?
So I think the views and the talking points around food, I think, are ones that, you know, have kind of, I think a lot of Americans feel that we wish our food supply, you know, had fewer additives. I think that's a very commonly held view. And there are questions, though, about whether if someone truly wanted to make changes to the food system, whether that the HHS role is the right place for it. I think, you know, probably have a lot more impact where he had been appointed to the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture secretary. That, you know, I think is one of the bigger levers on food. So, you know, I think it's possible that views on food, you know, may be generally well held. But I just do want to say that there's a reason why we're deeply concerned when he says I'm not anti-vaccines, because it really does stand in the direct opposition to the actions that he's taken. And although he did say in the hearing that, you know, he had vaccinated his children, he has also been on the record multiple times saying that that was a decision that he regrets. So he told part of the story in the hearing and not the other part of it. You know, I don't want to downplay people's concern about chronic illness. And that is, of course, I think a really important area of work to be done, but it can't be an either or. We can't only work on chronic illness and not work on infectious diseases. You know, increasingly we're finding linkages between the two. The body is a closed system. And so we need to be able to look at both. And we need to be able to do so as guided by the evidence and not guided by sort of personal dogma or personal profit.
Paul, can you chime in on this?
Yeah, I agree completely with Jennifer. I think we spend a lot of money in healthcare in this country, and we don't get a lot of bang for our buck. If you look at things like longevity or infant mortality, we're down the list compared to other developed world countries. Can we do better? Can we lessen obesity and then the consequences of obesity, like high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes? Of course. I think he struck a nerve when he talks about that. But don't for a minute think this man is anything other than anti-vaccine. On a 2023 podcast with Lex Fridman, he said he didn't think any vaccine was a benefit. He said that he thought the polio vaccine, his words, killed many, many more people than it saved. He says that when he sees a child on a running path or a hiking path and they're carrying a child, he goes up to that child and he says to the parent, don't vaccinate this child. And in that way, he feels he saved this child. And then, as Jennifer said, he said recently that if he had young children today, he would not vaccinate them according to the routine CDC schedule. So you can get what you want in terms of having somebody who does focus more on chronic diseases. And do we have the best healthcare system? But you don't have to include his baggage. And he has baggage. So to deny that he's anti-vaccine is to deny everything he said over the last 20 years.
I want to talk about the predicament of, and I want to thank you again, Christina, for the call. I want to talk about the predicament of the people who are taking in the news. Right now, we're talking about two people who live and breathe epidemiology. And outside of that, there are silos in the internet world. Most people are getting their information off the internet right now. And I don't know if there is a way to demonstrate to people or to convince people that what comes from a medical expert probably, or at least likely, has more validity than from someone who has no medical education. Jennifer, I'm sure you've come across this a number of times. Yeah. Is there anything one could do or say?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's about just, you know, telling people. And I you know, throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, I had the fortunate opportunity to be able to speak to lots of people, hundreds of people from, you know, various different walks of life. And, you know, people that had lots of questions about COVID and vaccines. And, you know, in those conversations, there were some real commonalities that I want to focus on. The first one is I very often heard from people who had these questions, first of all, just personal fears about what was going on. So it wasn't the case that they thought that COVID, you know, was necessarily a hoax, although clearly there are some people who do hold those views. But a lot of people just were nervous about it. And I would commonly hear from them, we just don't know who to trust. Mm-hmm. And I, at the beginning of the pandemic, I, you know, did something that we are often trained in public health to do, which is to say, well, do you think you could talk to your doctor or healthcare provider? And one of the things that I kept hearing over and over again, and it frankly just prompted me to stop saying that entirely, is that people would then say to me, I don't have one. And so I think this idea is partially about information, but it's also partially about people's unmet healthcare needs. And so we need to figure out a way to be in people's lives, not just in the times of emergency where we show up and say, trust us, take this, it's in your best interest, but to be able to build those kind of trusted relationships over time. I am deeply worried about this moment right now where we have potentially at the helm of our most important health agency, someone who has not only just spread lies for, you know, personal gain, but really has made a career of causing sort of casting doubts about the intentions of healthcare providers, that, you know, they're not in it for you. They're in it for their own gain, which is, you know, ironic given given the differential profits between the anti-vax businesses and healthcare. But I'm worried about that. And I'm also worried about the kind of political scrubbing of health information on our websites. And, you know, I think this is going to leave us in a situation where the American people not only no longer know who to trust, but now have just even fewer places to go to get information, to do their own research, absent, except for some of the most, spurious sources of information.
I want to get back to as much of the bird flu science as we can before the top of the hour. And in terms of the science, Paul, I'm guessing that the mutations we're hearing about, the mutations are inevitable. I mean, it would be nice to be wrong, but is there any way to contain mutations per se?
Well, first of all viruses mutate. Single-stranded RNA viruses, which is what influenza is, mutates even more. So it's always, viruses are always mutating. Measles virus is also a single-stranded RNA virus. That also mutates, but it's never mutated away from recognition by the immune response induced by the vaccine. And the vaccine was introduced first in 1963. So it's been 60 years of that vaccine. It's never mutated away from that vaccine. Flu is a little different. Flu is mutating constantly. So that the natural infection or immunization the year before often doesn't protect you against the virus that year. In fact, I trained in a flu lab in Walter Gerhardt's lab at the Wistar Institute back in the 80s. And he said something to me I'll never forget. He said, if you want to research career that lasts for the rest of your life, study influenza. And I think that, so it's always mutating. The question is staying on top of it. And you see COVID is mutating to the point that it can at least avoid antibody recognition. But you're never going to stop the mutations. You just have to recognize which viruses are mutating and how you can stay ahead of it. And I think for the most part, we do a very good job.
Talking to Dr. Paul Offit and Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo about the bird flu and about the potential confirmation of RFK Jr.'s nomination to head the HHS. Jennifer, so infected birds are being culled. Some cattle who don't recover are being slaughtered. I actually read something online this morning that made me laugh. Is the current price of eggs is Obama's fault. The future price of eggs will be Biden's fault. It's unfunny, though, that this is really expensive for people. So my question is twofold, and I start with you, Jennifer. Have previous outbreaks taught us anything about containing costs as the research and the effort to contain them goes on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. But before I talk about costs, I want to talk about something that we haven't brought up yet. And while I think there are swirling questions about whether currently circulating avian influenza virus is H5N1, H5N9, whether they have the potential to change or swap genes in order to cause a pandemic, mm-hmm. that is a scientific uncertainty. What we do know is that people are being exposed to these viruses today, and they are getting sick. And in some cases, they are getting severely ill. And so I just want to mention that because what I am most worried about today, and when we're talking about costs, we have to talk about the human costs. And I am worried about the farm workers who are being exposed to these viruses while doing their jobs to put food on our tables. So I believe that this is an important occupational hazard that we haven't sufficiently addressed. Mm-hmm. Now, this virus does not appear to be going away. It continues to pop up in states across the country. It continues to pop up on our farms. It continues to interfere with the operations of these farms and the not only the cost, but the availability of the products that these farms produce. I mean, I live in Rhode Island, and when I went to the store the other day, there was a giant sign on the egg case that said, we are out of eggs. And so we have to think about the long-term costs of these. And part of controlling these costs is not letting these viruses spread unchecked so that they could continue to show up on farms. It's also about not letting this virus find its way into people where, yes, we're giving it an opportunity potentially to mutate or swap genes with another influenza virus, such as a seasonal influenza virus, but also to not allow people to potentially experience severe illness. So I think we have to do more in terms of surveillance, testing on farms, giving farmers tools to be able to identify the virus and perhaps isolate their sick animals, protect their farm workers, make sure they get access to medicines. I also think we should be considering whether we should make vaccines available to the agricultural sector, given that these workers are going to continue to be exposed to these viruses unless something changes, and I don't see large changes occurring.
Well, let me stay with you about the concept of a vaccine for that. With the virus mutating, do we currently have a vaccine that would work against, that would be effective against what we're seeing?
Well, there are vaccines that are in various stages of development and stockpiling, and more work needs to be done before they could be used in people. But I think we haven't looked down the road far enough. I think we've sort of assumed that maybe this situation would blow over, or we've been reassured by the fact that so far the farm workers who have gotten ill have largely not gotten seriously ill. The discovery of D1.1, the virus that you mentioned, the kind of bird form, the more bird form of the avian influenza virus that we're talking about, that's the virus that's been associated with the more severe illness that we've seen in recent cases. And so there are questions about seeing this now in cows, what this will mean for the farm workers that may then become exposed to this virus. As an epidemiologist, when I see, you know, a handful of mild cases, I am never overly reassured that future such cases will all be similarly mild. I always know that, you know, as viruses play out over a larger portion of the population, we could very well see more severe illnesses occur just because all of us are different in how our bodies react, you know, how our immune systems react, et cetera, is different. So I think we have to be more forward looking. And again, my top concern today is not necessarily that a pandemic is imminent, but that farm workers are being unduly exposed and not given enough tools to protect themselves.
Yes. Yeah, I can see that. Paul, in terms of people protecting themselves, because we don't know exactly where this is going to go. I understand from my research online, correct me if I'm wrong on this, that, for example, if beef is contaminated and you are cautious to heat the beef, to cook the beef sufficiently, that's not going to be a problem for the average consumer right now. What else should consumers be aware of in terms of containing this in the human population and just a personal level?
Right. So influenza is an envelope virus, and therefore it doesn't do very well at sort of highly acid environments. So I think it's extremely unlikely that you're going to get influenza by eating it, by eating eggs or by eating, you know, meat that's contaminated, because the acid level in your stomach would really inactivate the virus. So if you look at viruses that are basically acquired via the intestine, they never have envelopes, you know, like rotavirus or poliovirus or enterovirus or Coxsackie virus or adenoviruses. They all are non-envelope viruses. So I think while it's reasonable, as Jennifer points out correctly, to be very careful and to really pay attention to how this virus is changing and how it might change as it continues to infect sort of more farm workers, I think that you can at least be reassured that it's unlikely you're going to get it by eating it.
Jennifer, what about our getting out of the WHO? What does that mean in terms of global containment? Do other countries move ahead and we don't benefit from that? Or will the United States be more likely to do well and not share it with other countries? What's the likely scenario there?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainties, but one of the things that we're already seeing is a shuttering or rollback of surveillance for these viruses, in part not just because of the withdrawal from WHO, but actually the pullback on USAID operations. I don't think people understand the work of USAID. I think perhaps maybe some people hear USAID and they're synonymous with foreign aid, you know, that we're just maybe thinking that we're just giving money to other countries. The reality is much of what USAID does is employing people and investing in capacities that do things like conduct surveillance for deadly viruses abroad to make sure they don't spread, to make sure that they're contained at their source and that they don't come here to the United States. And we're already hearing reports that pulling back, you know, basically putting the entire agency on administrative leave has led to a shuttering of some key surveillance programs. And I am deeply worried about what that will mean going forward. It also is not good from a normative perspective, meaning when the United States says, you know what, it's not important to look for these things, we're not gonna bother looking for these things, we're not gonna bother telling you about these things or participating in global organizations that keep each other apprised of these things, it could potentially lead to other countries deciding to do the same. And if we, you know, sort of erode the global compact that we think it's important to detect these health threats early and to share information about them transparently so that each country knows what it has to do in order to protect its own people, then, you know, we're going to have a very, very difficult time staying ahead of not just H5N1 and all the ways it may change, but future threats that we haven't even yet identified.
We've got just about 2 minutes left, and I want to talk about yourselves personally in this whole picture, because Trump, during COVID-19, he attacked not just public health policies, but he attacked public health officials, and he just took away Dr. Anthony Fauci's security detail, even though he's still receiving death threats. And I'm just wondering how concerned you both are about the attack on leaders in public health and your own safety and, you know, your own ability to work on without being publicly attacked. And I'll start with Paul on that one.
No, I think it's a troubled time. I feel like there's, as Jennifer alluded to earlier, sort of a rejection of expertise. I feel like science is kind of losing its place as a source of truth. People simply declare their own truths. This kind of medical freedom movement really implies that I can make my own decisions. I don't need these experts to tell me anything. In terms of my own personal safety, I don't really think about it. I work on a lot of denialism.
Jennifer, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really troubling. I am deeply worried that, you know, if you read a lot of reports about how to make America more economically prosperous, more competitive in the global economy, given all of the kind of new technologies that are emerging in the world, those reports all talk about the importance of making sure we have technical expertise in country and making sure in particular that they exist within our government agencies. I think what we've seen over the last 2+ weeks is just a fundamental attempt to dismantle those assets that we have. I worry about federal scientists feeling persecuted, feeling under attack, possibly choosing to leave the agencies that they devoted their careers to, and potentially, taking their skills elsewhere. I also worry that, someone is going to get killed from these personalizing attacks. You probably saw this week there was a publication of a DEI, essentially hit list that publicly named and posted pictures of federal scientists and federal personnel. This is incredibly dangerous.
Wow. Well, not exactly a cheerful hour, but just a critically important one. We've really been gifted with both of you. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzer, founder of the Outbreak Observatory, thank you so much for joining us, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Paul Offit, professor of vaccinology and pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Thank you as well. So pleased to have you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Plus, someday, hopefully, I'll get to meet Jennifer in person.
That would be wonderful.
I hope we facilitated that. And thank you for listening. To check out our past shows, if you missed any part of this show's, or to sign up for our podcast, all of that can be done at kalw.org/yourcall. You'll hear today's podcast. You can find us on iTunes, where we'd appreciate your giving us a review. Mail show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Nina Kissinger helped produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer, and thanks for joining us. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.